Do that, and I'll bring you a senator. The girl flinched as Commander Ga reached to pull the hair from her face, and she was wild-eyed with fear as the camera's tiny motor whirred her into focus. And then came the flash.
When our interns first arrived at Division 42, they were issued the standard items. Field smocks, which buttoned in the front. Interrogation smocks, which buttoned in the back. Clipboards, and finally, mandatory eyeglasses, which lend us an air of authority, thus further intellectually intimidating our subjects into compliance. All the members of the Pubyok team had been issued gear bags that contained items designed to brutalize and punish. Abrasion gloves, rubber mallets, stomach tubes, and so on. And it's true that our interns looked disappointed when we broke the news that our team had no need for such things. But tonight, we handed Jujak a pair of bolt cutters, and you could see his face light with a sense of mission. He hefted the cutters before his eyes to find their balance point, and Kyuki took possession of a cattle prod by rapid firing the trigger so fast that our room strobed blue. I didn't exactly travel in elite Yangban circles, so I had no way of knowing who this Comrade Pyok fellow would turn out to be. But I was sure he'd be an important chapter in our biography of Commander Ga. Then we all donned headlamps and surgical masks and took turns buttoning up the backs of each other's smocks before descending the ladders that led into the heart of the torture wing. As we were unscrewing the hatch that led down into the sump, Jujak asked us, "Is it true that old interrogators get sent to prison?" Our hands stopped turning. "The Pubyok are right about one thing," we told him. "Don't ever let a subject get inside your head." Once we were through the hatch, we sealed it behind us. Then we descended many metal rungs, protruding from the cement wall. Down here were four great pumps that pulled water from bunkers even deeper below. They activated a couple of times an hour, running for only a few minutes. But the heat and noise they generated was tremendous. This is where the Pubyok stored recalcitrant subjects, ones that were being softened by time and a humidity that steamed our lenses. A bar that ran the length of the room was bolted to the floor, and to this 30-odd subjects were chained. The floor was sloped for drainage, so that the poor fools on the lower side of the room slept in a skein of standing water. Few people roused as we crossed the room through a light drizzle of warm water that dripped from a concrete ceiling that was slick with green. We held our masks tight. Last year, diphtheria stole into the sump, taking all subjects and pocketing a few interrogators as well. Kyuki placed the prongs of the cattle prod against the iron bar and crackled off some juice. That got everyone's attention. Most of the subjects covered their faces on instinct or rolled into a baby position. A man at the end of the bar, down in the water, sat up and barked in pain. He wore a torn, soaked dress shirt, underwear, and sock suspenders around his calves. This was Comrade Pyok. We approached him and saw the vertical scar above his left eye. The wound had split the eyebrow in two, and it had healed so badly the halves of the brow missed each other. Who marries a woman that can't sew? "Are you Comrade Pyok?" we asked him. Pyok looked up, blinded by the headlamps. "What are you, the night shift?" he asked and laughed a feeble, unconvincing laugh. He put his hands up in mock defense. I confess," he said, but the laugh broke into a long cough, a sure sign of cracked ribs. Kyuki put the end of the prod in the water and pulled the trigger. Comrade Pyok was seized, while the naked man next to him rolled to one side and defecated into the black water. "Look, we don't like this," we told Pyok. "When we're in charge, We're going to close this place down. Oh, that's rich. Commander Pyok laughed.
You're not even in charge.
How'd you get that scar? We asked.
What? This?
He asked, pointing to the wrong eyebrow. Kyuki lowered the prod again, but we caught her hand. She was new. She was a woman, and we understood the pressure to prove oneself. But this was not our way. We clarified. How'd you get that scar from Commander Ga? We asked, and signaled Jujak to cut the chain. Answer that question for us, and we'll answer any question you like. A yes or no question, Kyuki added.
Yes or no?
Comrade Pyok asked in confirmation. It was a bold move from Kyuki, ill-advised, but we had to present a unified front. So we all nodded, and with a grunt from Jujak, the good comrade's chains fell. Comrade Pyok's hands went straight to his face to massage his eyes. We poured clean water on a handkerchief and handed it to him.
I worked in the same building with Commander Ga, Pyok said. I did procurement, so I had my head under a black hood all day, ordering supplies on the computer. China, mostly. Vietnam. Ga, he had his nice desk and a window, and he didn't do any work. This was before he began his feud with the Dear Leader, before Prison 9 burned. Back then, he didn't know anything about prisons or mines. The post was just a reward for winning the Golden Belt and for going to Japan to fight Kimura. That was a big deal after Yokio-san went to Japan to fight Sakuraba and defected. God would bring me lists of things he needed. Stuff like DVDs and rare bottles of rice wine.
Did he ever ask you to order fruit?
Fruit?
Peaches, perhaps. Did he want canned peaches? Pyok studied us.
No. Why?
Nothing. Continue.
One day I had worked late. It was just me and Commander Ga on the third floor. He often wore a white fighting tobok with a black belt, like he was in the gym, ready to spar. This night, he was leafing through magazines about taekwondo from South Korea. He liked to read illegal magazines right in front of us, saying he was studying the enemy. Just knowing about such a magazine could get you sent to Prison 15, the prison for families, the one they call Yodok. I often did the procurement for that prison. Anyway, these magazines have fold-out posters of fighters from Seoul. Gao was holding one up, appraising the fighter when he caught me looking at him. I had been warned about him, so I was nervous.
Kyuki interrupted. Was it a man who warned you or a woman?
Man,
Comrade Pyok said.
Commander Ga then stood. He had the poster in his hand. He grabbed something out of his desk and started walking toward me. And I thought, okay, I have been beaten up before. I can do this. I'd heard that once he beat you up, he never bothered you again. He began walking toward me. He was famous for his composure. When he fought, he never showed emotion. The only time he smiled was when he executed the tichagi, where he turned his back to the opponent, inviting his offense. Comrade, God said to me in a very mocking tone. Then he stands there, appraising me. People think I'm a sycophant, to go by comrade. But I'm a twin, and as is custom, we both have the same name. Our mother called us Comrade Pyok and Citizen Pyok to identify us. People thought it was cute. To this day,
My brother is Citizen Pyok.
Ah, we should have seen this information in his file. Missing it was a mistake on our part. Most people hate twins because of the procreation bonuses their families receive from the government. This explains much of Byuk's exterior and constitutes an advantage we should have exploited.
Commander Ga, Byuk continued, held a poster out for me to view. It was just a young black belt with a dragon tattooed on his chest.
Do you like this? Commander Ga asked. Does it interest you? He asked these questions in a way that implied a wrong answer, but I didn't know what that might be. Taekwondo is an ancient and noble sport, I told him, and I must get home to my family.
All the lessons you need to learn in life, he said, will be taught to you by your enemy.
Then for the first time, I'd noticed that what he'd brought with him was a dobok. This he tossed to me. It was damp and smelled of groin. I'd heard that if you didn't fight him, he beat you up. But if you did fight back, he might do something much worse to you, something unthinkable.
Very crisply, I said, I do not wish to wear a dobok.
Of course, he said, it is optional. I just looked at him, trying to see in his eyes what would happen next.
We are vulnerable, he told me. We must always be ready. First, let's check your core strength.
He unbuttoned my shirt and then pulled it open. He put his ear to my chest and thumped me on the sides and back. He repeated this with my stomach. He would thump me hard and say something like, lungs clear, kidneys strong, avoid the alcohol. Then he had to check my symmetry, he said. He had a little camera, very small, and he photographed my symmetry.
We asked Byuk, did Commander Ga wind the film, or was there a sound of a camera motor winding the film?
No, he said.
No whir or anything?
It beeped, Byuk said. Then Commander Ga said, the foreigner's first impulse is toward aggression. He told me I needed to learn how to fight off this force. Repelling foreign impulses from without is how you prepare yourself to repel them from within, he said. The commander then presented several scenarios like, what would I do if the Americans landed on the roof and rappelled down the air shafts? And what would I do if confronted with a Japanese man attack?
A man attack? I asked him.
He put his hand on my shoulder, pulled my arm straight, and got a hold of my hip.
A homosexual attack, Ga said, as if I was stupid.
The Japanese are famous for this. In Manchuria, the Japanese raped everything. Men, women, the pandas in the zoo.
It tripped me, and I went down, cutting my eye on the corner of a desk.
That's the story. That's how I got this scar. And now the answer to my question?
Here, Comrade Byuk stopped, as if he knew it drove us crazy not to get an ending.
Please do continue, we suggested.
I must have my answer first, he said. The other interrogators, the old ones, they're always lying to me. They say, tell us your means of secret communication. Your children would like to see you. They're right upstairs. Talk and you may visit with your wife. She's waiting for you. Tell us your role in the plot and you can go home with your family.
Our team does not use deception, we told them. We'll answer your question, and if you like, you can verify it for yourself.
We had brought Comrade Pyok's file. Juzak held it up, and Pyok recognized the folder's official blue sleeve and red tab. Comrade Pyok stared at us a moment, then said, when I fell, it was face first, and Commander Ga landed on my back. He just sat there, lecturing me. Blood filled my eye. Using his leverage, Commander Ga wrestled my right hand out, then twisted it back. Kyuki, wide-eyed with the story, said, "That move's called a reverse Kimura. You can't believe how it hurt. My shoulder, it was never the same. Please," I called out. "I was just working late. Please, Commander Ga, let me go." He released the hold, but continued to sit on my back. "How can you not fight off a man attack?" he asked. "For the love of everything, there's nothing worse. There's nothing more base that can happen to a man. In fact, he's not even a man after it. How could you not die trying to stop it, no matter what? Unless you wanted it. Unless you secretly wanted a man attack, and that's why you failed to repel it. Well, you're lucky it was only me and not some Japanese. You're lucky I was strong enough to protect you. You should be thanking your stars I was here to stop it." "And that's it?" we asked. "That's where it stopped?" Comrade Pyok nodded. "Did Commander Ga show any remorse?" "The last thing I remember was the flash of that camera again. I was face down. There was blood everywhere." For a moment, Comrade Pyok was silent. The whole room was quiet, nothing but the sound of urine trickling downhill. Then Pyok asked, "Is my family alive?" This is where the Pyubyok are better at handling some things. "I have prepared myself," Comrade Pyok said. "The answer is no," we said. We moved Pyok out of the water and we chained him uphill. Then we began gathering our gear and heading for the ladders. His eyes were looking inward, a look we're trained to recognize as a signifier of sincerity, since it's nearly impossible to fake. True self-searching cannot be imitated. Then Pyok looked up. "I will look at the file," he said. We held it out to him. "Be careful," we warned. "There's a photo." He paused at the cusp of taking the folder. We said, "The investigator said it was probably carbon monoxide poisoning. They were found in the dining room near the heater where they were all overtaken before succumbing together." "My daughters?" Comrade Pyok said. "Were they wearing white dresses?" "One question," we said. "That was the deal. Unless you want to help us understand why Commander Ga pulled this stunt with the actress." Comrade Pyok said, "Commander Ga didn't have anything to do with the missing actress. He went into prison 33 and didn't come out. He died down there in the mine." Pyok then cocked his head at us. "Wait, which Commander Ga are you talking about?" "There are two of them, you know. The Commander Ga who gave me the scar is dead." "You were talking about the real Commander Ga?" we asked. "Why would the false Commander Ga apologize for what the real Commander Ga did to you?" "He apologized? The imposter told us he was sorry for your scar, for what he did to you." "That's ridiculous," Pyok said. "Commander Ga has nothing to be sorry for. He gave me the thing I wanted most, the one thing I couldn't procure for myself." "And what was that?" we asked. "Why, he killed the real Commander Ga, of course." We all exchanged a glance. "So in addition to killing the actress and her children, you were saying he killed the DPRK commander as well?" "He didn't kill Sun Moon and her children. God turned them into little birds and taught them a sad song. Then they flew away towards sunset to a place where you'll never find them." We suddenly wondered if it wasn't true, if the actress and her children weren't in hiding someplace. God was alive, wasn't he? But who had her? Where was she being held? It was easy to make somebody disappear in North Korea, but making them reappear? Who has that kind of magic? "If you helped us, we would find a way to help you," we told Pyok. "Help you? My family is gone. My friends are gone. I'm gone. I won't ever help you. Okay, we said and began gathering our gear. It was late, and we were wiped. I had noticed that Comrade Pyok was wearing a wedding ring, one made of gold. I told Jujak to take it. Jujak looked back with trepidation, then took Pyok's hand and tried to shimmy it off.
It's too tight, Jujak said.
Hey, Comrade Pyok said. Hey, that's all I have left of them, of my wife and daughters. Come on, I told Jujak. The subject doesn't need it anymore. Chuki hefted the bolt cutters. I will get that ring off, she said.
I hate you,
Comrade Pyok said. He twisted hard, cutting skin, and then the ring was in my pocket. We turned to go.
I won't ever tell you anything,
Comrade Pyok yelled at us.
You have no power over me now, nothing. Do you hear me? I'm free now. You have no power over me. Are you listening to me?
One by one, we began climbing the rungs that led out of the sump. They were slippery and required caution.
11 years,
Comrade Pyok called out, his voice echoing off the wet cement.
11 years I procured for those prisons. The uniforms come in children's sizes, you know. I've ordered thousands of them. They even make a half-sized pickaxe. Do you have children? For 11 years, the prison doctors order no bandages and the cooks ask for no ingredients. We ship them only millet and salt. Tons and tons of millet and salt. No prison has ever requested a pair of shoes or even a single bar of soap. But they must have transfusion bags right away. They must have bullets and barbed wire tomorrow. I prepared my family. They knew what to do. Are you prepared? Do you know what you would do?
Climbing hand over hand up the galvanized steps, those of us with children tried to keep focus. But the interns, always the interns, think they are invincible, right? Chiki led the way with her headlamp. When she stopped and looked down at the rest of us, we all stopped too. We looked up at her, a halo of light above us. She asked,
Ryokto-san defected?
We were all silent. In the quiet, you could hear Pyok preaching about children being stoned and hanged, going on and on. Kyuki let out a groan of pain and disappointment.
Ryokto-san too, she said, shaking her head. Is there anyone left who's not a coward?
Then the pumps kicked in, and thankfully, we couldn't hear anything.
When Commander Ga returned to Sun Moon's house, he was wearing the Western pistol on his hip. Before he could knock on the door, Brando alerted the house to his presence. Sun Moon answered in a simple Chosonot. Its jogori was white, and the chima was patterned with pale blossoms. It was the peasant girl dress she'd worn in the movie, a true daughter of the country. Today, she did not banish him to the tunnel. He'd been to work and now he was home, and he was greeted as a normal husband returning from the office. The son and daughter were standing at attention in their school uniforms, though they hadn't been going to school. She hadn't let them out of her sight since he'd arrived. He called the girl, girl, and the boy, boy, because Sun Moon refused to tell him their names. The daughter held a wooden tray. On it was a steaming towel, which he used to wipe the dust from his face and neck, the backs of his hands. Upon the boy's tray were various medals and pins placed there by his father. Commander Ga emptied his pockets onto the tray. Some military won, subway tickets, his ministry ID card. And in the commingling of these everyday objects, the two Commander Ga's were one. But when a coin fell to the floor, the boy flinched in fear. If the ghost of Commander Ga was anywhere, it was here, in the worried posture of the children, in the punishment they seemed convinced was continually at hand. Next, his wife held open a tobok like a drape, so that he could disrobe before them in privacy. When the tobok was cinched, Sun Moon turned to the children.
"Go,"
she told them.
"Go practice your music."
When they were gone, she waited for the sounds of their warm-up scales before speaking, and then when their notes seemed too soft, she made for the kitchen, where the loudspeaker was playing, and she was sure not to be overheard. He followed her, watched her cringe when she recognized that over the loudspeaker, the new opera diva was singing Sea of Blood. Sun Moon relieved him of his weapon. She opened the cylinder and assured herself the chambers were empty. Then she gestured at Ga with the butt of the gun.
"I must know how you came by this pistol," she said.
"It's custom made," he said. "One of a kind."
"Oh, I recognize the gun," she said. "Tell me who gave it to you."
She pulled a chair to the counter and climbed atop it. She reached high to place the gun in the top cupboard. He watched her body elongating, taking a different shape under her chosen ot. Its hem lifted to show her ankles, and there she was, the whole weight of her balanced upon poised toes. He regarded that cabinet, wondering what else it might contain. Commander Ga's pistol was in the back seat of the Mercedes, yet he asked, "Did your husband carry a gun?"
"Does,"
she said. "Does your husband carry a gun?"
"You're not answering my question,"
she said.
"I know the gun you brought home. We've used it in a half-dozen movies. It's the pearl-handled pistol that the cold-blooded cowboyish American officer always uses to shoot civilians."
She stepped off the chair and dragged it back to the table. There were marks on the floor showing this had happened many times before.
"Doc Ho gave this to you from the prop warehouse," she said. "Either he's trying to send me some kind of message, or I don't know what's going on."
"The dear leader gave it to me," he said. A pain crossed Sun Moon's face.
"I can't stand that voice," she said.
The new diva had made it to the Aria, celebrating the martyred sniper teams of Myohyang.
"I have to get out of here,"
she said, and stepped outside onto the deck. He joined her in the warm afternoon sunlight, the view from the top of Mount Taesong encompassing all of Pyongyang. Below them, swallows turned in the air above the botanical gardens. In the cemetery, old people prepared for their deaths by opening lantern paper parasols and visiting the graves of others. She smoked a cigarette as her eyes got wet, her makeup soon running. He stood next to her at the rail. He didn't know if you could tell whether an actress was really crying. He only knew, real or fake, the tears were not for her husband. Perhaps she wept because she was 37 now, or because friends no longer visited, or for the way her children, in their play theater, punished the puppets for talking back. "The dear leader told me he was writing a new movie role for you." Sun Moon turned her head to exhale smoke.
"The dear leader only has room in his heart for opera now,"
she said, and offered him the last draw of her cigarette. Ga took it and inhaled.
"I knew you were from the country," she said. "Look at how you hold that cigarette. What do you know of the dear leader, or whether a new movie will happen or not?"
Ga reached for her cigarettes and lit a new one for himself. "I used to smoke," he said. "But in prison, I lost the habit."
"Is that supposed to mean something to me, prison?"
"They showed us a movie in there. It was A True Daughter of the Country." She planted her elbows against the balcony rail and leaned back. It lifted her shoulders high, made visible the blades of her pelvis through the white of her chosen ot. She said,
"I was just a kid when I made that movie. I didn't know anything about acting."
She gave him a look as if to ask, "How was the movie received?" "I used to live by the sea," he said. "For a short time, I almost had a wife. I mean, maybe. It could have been." She was the wife of a shipmate, quite beautiful.
But if she was a wife, she was already married,
Sun Moon said, and looked at him, confused.
Why are you telling me this?
Oh, but her husband disappeared, Commander Goss said. Her husband just went off into the light. In prison, when things were not so good, I tried to think of her, my almost wife, my maybe wife, to keep me strong. An image of the captain came to him, of the captain's wife tattooed on the captain's ancient chest. How the once black ink had turned blue and hazy as it migrated under the old man's skin. A watercolor, where indelibility had been, leaving only the stain of the woman he loved. That's what had happened to the second mate's wife in prison. She'd gone out of focus. She'd seeped from his memory. Then I saw you on the movie screen, and I realized how plain she had been. She could sing. She had ambitions. But you showed me that she was only an almost beauty, a maybe beauty. The truth was that when I thought of the missing woman in my life, it was your face that I saw.
This almost maybe wife, she said. What happened to her?
He shrugged.
Nothing? She asked. You never saw her again?
Where would I see her? He asked. Though he hadn't noticed, Sun Moon perceived her children had stopped playing their instruments. She went to the door and shouted until they resumed. She turned to him.
You should probably tell me why you were in prison.
I went to America, where my mind was soiled by capitalist ways.
California?
Texas, he said, where I got the dog. She crossed her arms.
I don't like any of this, she said. You must be part of my husband's plan. He must have sent you as some kind of stand-in. Otherwise, his friends would have killed you. I don't know why you're here, saying these things to me, and no one has killed you.
She gazed toward Pyongyang, as if the answer were there. He watched emotions cross her face like weather. Uncertainty, like clouds blotting the sun, gave way to a wince of regret. Eyes twitching as with the first drops of rain. She was a great beauty, it was certainly true. But he saw now that what made him fall in love with her in prison was this. The way what was felt in her heart came instantly to her face. That was the source of her great acting. This thing that couldn't be faked. You'd have to have 20 tattoos, he realized, to capture her moods. Dr. Song had made it to Texas, where he'd eaten barbecue. Gil had gotten to sip scotch and make a Japanese bartender laugh. And here he was, on Commander Ga's balcony with Sun Moon, tear streaks on her face, backdropped by Pyongyang. It didn't matter what happened to him now. He leaned toward her. That would make the moment perfect, to touch her. Everything would be worth it if he could wipe a tear from her cheek. She eyed him warily.
You said the husband of your almost wife. You said he disappeared, that he went off into the light. Did you kill him?
No, he told her. That man defected. He escaped on a life raft. When we went to look for him, the morning sun off the ocean was so bright, it was like the light had swallowed him. He had the image of his wife tattooed on his chest, so he would always have her. Even if she didn't have him. But don't worry. I won't let you become a hazy memory. She didn't like the answer or the way he told it, he could tell. But his story was part of her story now. It couldn't be helped. He reached to touch her cheek.
Stay away from me, she said.
Your own husband, if you want to know, it was the darkness for him, he said. Your husband went off into the dark. From somewhere below came the sound of a truck engine. Vehicles rarely came up the mountain, so Ga peered down into the woods, hoping to catch sight of it through a break in the trees. "You don't have to worry," Ga said to her. "The truth is that the deer leader has an assignment for me, and when that's over, I expect you won't see me again." He looked at her to see if she'd registered what he'd said.
"I've worked with the deer leader for many years," she told him. 12 motion pictures. I wouldn't be so sure about what he does or doesn't have in mind."
The sound grew until the engine was unmistakable, a heavy diesel with a low grind in the gearing. From the house next door, Comrade Byuk stepped out onto his balcony and stared down into the woods. But he didn't need to spot the truck for a grim look to cross his face. He and Ga caught each other's eyes in a long, wary glance. Comrade Byuk called to them,
"Come join us. There's little time."
Then he went inside.
"What is it?"
Sun Moon asked. Ga said, "It's a crow."
"What's a crow?"
At the railing, they waited for the truck to pass into a visible stretch of road. "There," he said when the black canvas of its canopy flashed through the trees. "That's a crow." For a moment, the two of them watched the truck slowly climb the switchbacks toward their house.
"I don't get it," she said.
"There's nothing to get," he said. "That's the truck that takes you away." In 33, he'd often fantasized about what he'd have grabbed from the aircraft hangar if he'd had even a minute's notice that he was headed for a prison mine. A needle, a nail, a razor. What he wouldn't have given for those things in prison. A simple piece of wire, and he'd have had a bird snare. A rubber band could have triggered a rat trap. How many times he longed for a spoon to eat with. But now he had other concerns. "You take the kids into the tunnel," Ga said. "I'll go and meet the truck." Sun Moon turned to Ga with a look of horror on her face.
"What's happening?"
she asked.
"Where does that truck take you?"
"Where do you think it takes you?" he asked. "There's no time. Just take the kids down. It's me they're after."
"I'm not going down there alone," she said. "I've never even been down there. You can't abandon us in some hole."
Comrade Byuk came onto his balcony again. He was buttoning his collar.
"Come over,"
he said, and threw a black tie around his neck.
"We are ready over here. Time is short, and you must join us."
Instead, Ga went to the kitchen and stood before the washtub on the floor. The washtub was fixed to a trap door that lifted to reveal the ladder down to the tunnel. Ga took a deep breath and descended. He tried not to think of the mine head of Prison 33, of entering the mine in darkness every morning and emerging from the mine in darkness each night. Sun Moon brought the boy and the girl. Ga helped them down and pulled a string that turned on the light bulb. When it was Sun Moon's turn at the ladder, he told her, "Get the guns."
"No," she said. "No guns."
Ga helped her down and then closed the trap door. Her husband had rigged a wire that pulled the pump handle, and in this way, Ga was able to fill the tub with a few liters of water to disguise the entrance. The four of them stood by the ladder a moment, their eyes unable to adjust as the bulb swung from its wire. Then Sun Moon said,
"Come, children,"
and took their hands. They began walking into the darkness, only to realize that after just 15 meters, barely enough to get beyond the house and the road out front, the tunnel came to an end.
"Where's the rest of it?"
Sun Moon asked.
"Where's the way out?"
He walked a little into the darkness toward her, but stopped.
"There's no escape route?"
she asked.
"There's no exit?"
She came to him, her eyes wheeling in disbelief.
"What have you been doing down here all these years?"
Ga didn't know what to say.
"Years," she said. "I thought there was a whole bunker down here. I thought there was a system. But this is just a hole. What have you been spending your time on?"
Lining the tunnel were some bags of rice and a couple of barrels of grain, their UN seal still unbroken.
"There's not even a shovel down here," she said.
Midway into the tunnel was the sole furnishing, a padded chair and a bookcase filled with rice wine and DVDs. She grabbed one and turned to him.
"Movies?"
she asked. Ga could tell she would scream next. But then they all looked up. There was a vibration, the muted sound of a motor, and suddenly dirt loosened from the roof of the tunnel and fell into their faces. A sort of terror came over the children as they coughed and clutched their dirt-filled eyes. Ga walked them back toward the ladder and the light. He wiped their faces with a sleeve of his dobok. In the house above, they heard a door open, followed by footsteps crossing the wood floors, and suddenly the trap door was lifting. Sun Moon's eyes went wide with shock, and she took hold of him. When Ga looked up, there was a bright square of light. In it appeared the face of Comrade Byuk.
"Please, neighbors," Comrade Byuk said. "This is the first place they'll look."
He lowered a hand to Ga.
"Don't worry," Comrade Byuk said. "We'll take you with us."
Commander Ga took the hand. "Let's go," he said to Sun Moon, and when she didn't move, he yelled,
"Now!"
The little family snapped to and scrambled out of the tunnel. Together they cut through the side yard and into Byuk's kitchen. Inside, Byuk's daughters sat around a table covered in white embroidery. Byuk's wife was pulling a white dress over the last daughter's head, while Comrade Byuk brought extra chairs for the guests. Ga could tell that Sun Moon was at the edge of unraveling, but the calmness of Byuk's family wouldn't allow her to do so. Ga and Sun Moon sat across from the Byuk family, with the boy and the girl between them, the four of them dusted with dirt. In the center of the table was a can of peaches and the key to open it. They all ignored the crow idling out front. Comrade Byuk passed a stack of glass dessert bowls around, and then he passed the spoons. Very carefully, he opened the peaches, so quietly you could hear the key punch and cut, punch and cut, the tin complaining as the key went around the rim in its jagged circle. Very carefully, Byuk peeled back the tin lid with a spoon so as not to come in contact with the syrup. The nine of them sat in silence looking at the peaches. Then a soldier entered the house. Under the table, the boy took Ga's hand, and Ga gave the small hand a reassuring squeeze. When the soldier came to the table, no one moved. He had no chrome Kalashnikov, no weapon at all that Ga could tell. Comrade Byuk pretended not to see him. "All that matters is that we are together," he said, then spooned a single slice of peach into a glass bowl. This he passed, and soon a circle of glass bowls, a single peach slice in each, was rounding the table. The soldier stood there a moment, watching.
"I'm looking for Commander Ga," he said.
He seemed unwilling to believe that either of these men could be the famous Commander Ga.
"I'm Commander Ga."
Outside, they could hear a winch operating.
"This is for you,"
the soldier said, and handed Ga an envelope. Inside was a car key and an invitation to a state dinner that evening, upon which someone had handwritten, "Would you do us the pleasure of your company?" Outside, a classic Mustang, baby blue, was being lowered from the back of the crow. With a winch, the car crawled backward down two metal ramps. The Mustang was just like the classic cars he'd seen in Texas. He approached the car, ran a hand down its fender. Though you couldn't quite see it, there were dimples and troughs attesting to how the body had been fashioned from raw metal. The bumper wasn't chrome, but plated in sterling silver, and the taillights were made from blown red glass. Ga stuck his head underneath the body. It was a web of improvised struts and welded mounts, connecting a handmade body to a Mercedes engine and a Soviet Lada frame. Comrade Byuk joined him by the car. He was clearly in a great mood, relieved, exuberant.
"That went great in there," he said. "I knew we wouldn't need those peaches. I just had a feeling. It's good for the kids, though. Dry runs like that. Practice is the key."
"What did we just practice?" Ga asked him. Byuk just smiled with amazement and handed Ga an unopened can of peaches.
"For your own rainy day," Byuk said. "I helped close down Fruit Factory 49 before they burned it. I got the last case on the canning line."
Byuk was so impressed, he shook his head.
"It's like no harm can come to you, my friend," he said.
You've managed something I've never seen before. And I knew we'd be okay. I knew it. Ga's eyes were red, his hair dusted with dirt. What have I managed? He asked. Comrade Byuk gestured at the car, the house. This, he said. What you're doing. What am I doing? There's no name for it, Byuk said. There's no name, because no one's ever done it before. The rest of the day, Sun Moon locked herself in the bedroom with the children, and there was the silence that comes only from sleep. Even the afternoon news on the loudspeaker did not wake them. Down in the tunnel, it was just Commander Ga and his dog, whose breath was foul from eating a raw onion, executing trick after trick. Finally, when the lowering sun was rust-colored and waxen, amber-bright off the river, they emerged. Sun Moon wore a formal jozonot the color of platinum, so exquisite the silk shone like crushed diamonds in one flash, then dark as lamp smudge the next. Seed pearls trimmed the gorum. While she prepared the tea, the children positioned themselves on elevated pallets to play their instruments. The girl began with her gayagum, obviously an antique from the days of court. Wrists erect, she plucked in the old sanjo way. The boy tried his best to accompany on the tegum. His lungs were not quite strong enough to play the demanding flute, and because his hands were too small to finger the high notes, he sang them instead. Sun Moon kneeled before Commander Ga and began the Japanese tea ritual. She spoke as she removed the tea from an alderwood box and infused it in a bronze bowl. These items, she said, indicating the tray, the cups, the whisk, the ladle. Do not be fooled by them. They are not real. They are only props from my last movie, Comfort Woman. Sadly, it never premiered. She steeped the tea, making sure it turned clockwise in a bamboo cup. In the movie, I must serve afternoon tea to the Japanese officers, who will afterward make me their business for the rest of the evening. He asked, Am I the occupying force in this story? She turned his cup slowly in her hands, awaiting the proper infusion. Before handing it to him, she cast her breath once upon the tea, rippling the surface. The cape of her jozonot spread in a shimmer around her. She passed him his tea and then bowed, down to the wooden floor, the full form of her body displaying itself. Her cheek against the wood, she said, It was only a movie. While Sun Moon retrieved his finest uniform, Ga drank and listened. In the sideways light, the windows to the west gave the illusion that he could see all the way to Nampo and the Bay of Korea. The song was elegant and clean, and even the children's off notes made the music pleasingly spontaneous. Sun Moon dressed him, and then standing, pinned the appropriate medals to his chest. This one, she said, came from the deer leader himself. What was it for? She shrugged. Pin it at the top, he said. She raised her eyebrows at his wisdom and complied. And this one was presented by General Guk for unspecified acts of bravery. Her attention and beauty had distracted him. He forgot who he was and his situation. Do you think, he asked, that I am brave and unspecified? She buttoned the breast pocket of his uniform and gave a final pull on his tie. I do not know, she said, if you are a friend of my husband or an enemy. But you are a man, and you must promise to protect my children. What almost happened today, it can't happen again. He pointed at a large medal she had not pinned on him. It was a ruby star with the golden flame of Juche behind it. What's that one? He asked. Please, she said, just promise me. He nodded, and he did not leave her eyes. That medal was for defeating Kimura in Japan, she said. Though really, it was for not defecting afterward. The medal was just part of a package. A package of what?
This house, she said. Your position. Other things. Defect. Who would leave you? That is a good question, she said. But at the time, my hand was not yet Commander Ga's.
So I beat Kimura, huh? Go ahead and pin it on me.
No, she said.
Ga nodded, trusting her judgment.
Should I wear the pistol? He asked.
She shook her head. Before leaving, they stopped to regard, behind a casing of glass and illuminated by a spotlight, the golden belt. The display was positioned to be the first thing a visitor noticed when entering the house.
My husband, Sun Moon said,
but did not finish the thought. Her mood lightened in the car. The sun was going down, but the sky was still pale blue. Ga had driven only trucks in the military, but he got the hang of it, despite how the Mercedes engine jammed the little Lada gearbox. The interior, though, was beautiful. Mahogany dash, mother-of-pearl gauges. At first, Sun Moon had wished to sit in the back seat by herself, but he talked her into the front, saying that in America, the ladies drive with their men. "Do you like this car, the Mustang?" he asked her. "The Americans make the best cars. This one is quite revered there."
"I know this car," she said. "I have been in it before."
"I doubt that," Ga said. They were winding down the mountain, driving just fast enough to elude the dust cloud behind them. "This is surely the only Mustang in Pyongyang. The dear leader had it custom-built to embarrass the Americans, to show them we could make their own car, only better, more powerful." Sun Moon ran her hands across the upholstery. She flipped down the passenger visor, looked at herself in the mirror.
"No," she said. "This is the car I was in. It was a prop in one of my movies, the one where the Americans are repelled and MacArthur is caught fleeing. This was the car the coward tried to escape in. I had a scene right here, in this seat. I had to kiss a traitor to get information. That was years ago, that movie."
Talk of movies had fouled her mood, he could tell. They drove alongside the Revolutionary Martyrs Cemetery. The Songun guard with their golden rifles had gone home for the day, and in the long shadows cast by the bronze headstones moved occasional men and women. In the growing dark, these ghostly figures, keeping low and moving quickly, were gathering all the flowers from the graves.
"Always they are stealing flowers,"
Sun Moon remarked as they passed by.
"It sickens me. My great uncle is in there, you know. Do you know what that says to our ancestors? How it must insult them?"
Ga asked her. "Why do you think they steal the flowers?"
"Yes, that's the question, isn't it? Who would do that? What's happening to our country?"
He stole a brief glance to confirm her disbelief. Had she never been hungry enough to eat a flower? Did she not know that you could eat daisies, daylilies, pansies, and marigolds? That hungry enough, a person could consume the bright faces of violas, even the stems of dandelions and the bitter hips of roses? They crossed the Chongnyu Bridge, drove through the south of the city, and crossed again on the Yanggakdo. It was dinner time, and there was wood smoke in the air. In the twilight, the Taedong River reminded him of mineshaft water, ore dark and cold. She instructed him to take Sosung Street toward the Putong, but amid the thick apartment buildings that lined Cholima, something slammed onto the hood of their car. A gun had gone off, that's what he thought at first, or some kind of collision. Commander Ga stopped in the road, and he and Sun Moon got out, leaving their doors open. The road was wide and unlit. There were no other cars. It was the time of evening when blues and grays grew together. People had been grilling turnips at the curb. A band of bitter smoke stood in the air, waist high. They congregated around the car to see what had happened. There on the hood was a baby goat, its horns just stubs and its eyes loose and wet. Some people looked up to the rooftops where other animals continued to graze as the first stars appeared above. There was no gore, but you could see the goat's little eyes go milky and fill with blood. Sun Moon covered her face, and Ga put his hand on her shoulder. Suddenly, a young woman broke from the crowd. She snatched the baby goat and bolted down the street. They watched her run, the goat's bouncing head, its blood spittle streaking down her back. The crowd, he realized, was now staring at him. He was a Yangban in their eyes, with his fancy uniform and beautiful wife. They arrived late to the Grand People's Opera House, empty save for a few dozen couples in small groups, their conversations reduced to murmurs by the huge ceilings and cascades of black silk curtains and mulberry-colored carpets. In one of the upper balconies stood a tenor. With his hands clasped, he sang Arirang, while below, despite the drinks and delicacies, the guests attempted to find some pleasure in the hollow time before they were rewarded with the dear leader's spirited company. Arirang, arirang, the tenor sang. Arario.
That, Sun Moon said, is Dak Ho. He runs the Central Cinema Studio. But his voice, no other man's is his match.
Commander Ga and Sun Moon moved watchfully toward the couples. How beautiful she was crossing the room, taking quick small steps, her shape so perfectly implied in the drape of Korean silk. The men were the first to acknowledge her. In their dress uniforms and assembly suits, they showed their gold smiles, as if Sun Moon hadn't been absent from the Yangban set for so long. They seemed indifferent to the cancellation of her movie premiere, or to her arrival with a strange man in her husband's uniform, as if all these weren't signs they'd lost one of their own. The women, however, broadcast open scorn. Perhaps they believed if they closed ranks against her, Sun Moon might not transmit to them the malady they feared most. Sun Moon stopped suddenly and turned to Ga, as if overcome by an impulse to kiss him. Showing her back to those women, she looked into Ga's eyes as if looking for her own reflection.
"I am a talented actress, and you are my husband," she said. "I am a talented actress, and you are my husband."
Ga looked into her uncertain, unseeing eyes. "You are a talented actress," he said, "and I am your husband." Then she turned, smiled, and they strode forward. One man broke from the group to intercept them. At his approach, Sun Moon stiffened.
"Commander Park," she said, "how have you been?"
"Fine, thank you,"
he said to Sun Moon, and with a jackknife bow, he kissed her hand. Rising, he said,
"And Commander Ga, how long has it been?"
Park's face was marked from a naval firefight with an ROK patrol boat.
"Too long, Commander Park. Much too long." "True," Park said. "But tell me, have you noticed something different about me?"
Ga looked at Park's uniform, at his fat rings and tie, but really he couldn't help being drawn to the striated scars on one side of his face.
"Certainly,"
Ga said. "The change is for the better."
"Really?"
Commander Park said.
"I thought you would be angry. You are the most competitive person."
Ga glanced over at Sun Moon. He thought she might be relishing this moment, but her face was fixed, wary. Commander Park fingered a medal on his chest.
"You will win your own Songun Cross one day,"
he said.
"True. It's only given once a year. But don't let that deter you."
Ga said, "Perhaps I will be the first to win two in a row then." Commander Park laughed.
"That's a good one, Ga. That is so like you."
He placed a hand on Ga's shoulder, as if to whisper something humorous in his ear. Instead, he grabbed Ga's collar, pulling him down to deliver a vicious uppercut to Ga's midsection, a liver punch that knuckled under the ribs. Then Park strode away. Sun Moon took hold of Ga and tried to usher him to a seat, but no, he wished to stand.
"Always men must come to that," she said.
Between shallow breaths, Commander Ga asked,
Who was that?
Sun Moon said,
That was your best friend.